This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
According to the Uganda AIDS Commission, the country records 50,000 new infections annually, about one third of them being young people.
That's Halimna Aftumani reporting on memorials to Uganda's persistent HIV/AIDS problem. Also, deadly floods strike the Malian capital Bamako, and Zimbabweans face water shortages and go with a troubled economy and electricity blackouts. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Uganda is marking the International AIDS Candlelight Memorial with activities to remember an estimated 2 million Ugandans who died of the disease. While the government is doing more to treat and support people infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, a strong stigma remains. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
While the government and development partners have increased campaigns for HIV awareness, stigma and discrimination keep many Ugandans fearful from learning of or talking about their HIV status. 25-year-old Namanya Martin Paul was born with HIV. Having lost his father to AIDS at the age of 2, he only learned about his status at age 10 when his mother, also HIV positive, was attending antenatal care. His other three siblings were then found to be HIV positive. Namanya was forced to change schools due to discrimination until he made a decision to open up.
It's not easy. There's a particular point in time where a nurse got to know about my situation, where I was keeping my medication, and actually made it like very open to school. So I called for a school parade and told these people, this is who I am. I'm living with HIV. I'm taking my medication and you need to support me.
The International AIDS Candlelight Memorial is one of the world's oldest and largest grassroots mobilization campaigns for HIV awareness. According to the Uganda AIDS Commission, the country records 50,000 new infections annually, about one third of them being young people. Sarah Naku, the UN AIDS Community Mobilization Advisor, says many infected people are careful about revealing their status.
We do have laws that discriminate against people living with HIV, that instead of allowing people to come out openly, incidentally people decide to hide because they do not want to fall victims of the law. We also have schools where discrimination does happen. If you don't tap into the teachers, this young person cannot be supported to adhere on treatment.
In 2018, the government launched an initiative that demands every institution, both government and private, address the needs of HIV-positive people as part of its workplace policy. Dr. Nelson Musoba, Director General of the Uganda AIDS Commission, says that even though the government has set up more effective measures to curb the disease, Ugandans need to be more careful about exposing themselves to HIV.
So we also have the pre-exposure prophylaxis, where the HIV-negative partner takes to ensure that they remain HIV-negative. There's research going on vaccine, on other treatments, but we need to stay alive for us to benefit from those technologies. So we can't afford to be reckless just because there's treatment.
The Ministry of Health says Uganda is close to achieving its 90-90-90 target set in 2014. The aim is for 90% of people living with HIV to know their status, 90% who test positive to enroll in care and treatment, and 90% of those in treatment to achieve viral load suppression, that is, for the virus to become inactive. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Malian officials say flooding in the capital Bamako killed 15 people and injured 2 yesterday. Officials called the total provisional. A spokesman for the Ministry of Internal Security said The flooding overnight caused serious damage and rescue teams were being deployed. 10 of the deaths took place in Namiakoro, where a bridge was badly damaged. People living in Bamako blamed the government for not removing garbage from canals meant to prevent flooding. The waters quickly receded, leaving behind thick mud and damaged buildings and cars. The flooding takes place at the start of the rainy season in Mali, which is Africa's mostly dry Sahel region. The Rwandan Investigation Bureau paraded a top FNL leader before media today. Major Kaliste Sankara is the spokesperson of the rebel group that Rwanda says has been carrying out attacks around the country. The Bureau has neither revealed where he is incarcerated nor details of his extradition, but says he is in good condition. Eugene Uimana has more details from Kigali.
The hall was packed with local and foreign journalists who had been impatiently waiting to see and hear Sankara, who had claimed he was about to take over the country. Two police officers led the handcuffed but smiling Sankara, dressed in civilian clothes and sunglasses, into the room where he stood before the media for about 2 minutes. After saying that Sankara wouldn't talk to the media, the spokesperson of Rwanda Investigation Bureau, Modeste Mbabazi, offered assurance that he is in good condition. He says you saw him, he doesn't have any problem. The only problem he has, of course, is that he's in jail. No one gets happy being in jail, says Mbabazi. While offering a few details, Mbabazi repeated President Paul Kagame's warnings that every traitor can be caught regardless of how, where he hides. What I can tell you is that there is no far from the justice. When a person is destabilizing the country, he can be caught wherever he might be. Justice can grab him. Several critics say many lawyers have refused to defend Sankara, saying they fear the arm of the government. But Moise Mundabarashi, Sankara's lawyer, says he believes laws can provide protection. He said Sankara is the one who chose him. There are many laws protecting lawyers in Rwanda. He says, I don't need any cover which is not laws which govern our profession in this country. Among the attacks that Sankara is accused of carrying out came last June when 2 people were killed, 8 wounded and others taken hostage when 3 passenger cars were tortured in the Nyungwe forest. Sankara is the 3rd major terrorism suspect taken into custody, along with 2 officials of the FDL rebel group. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, has a long history of periodic water shortages. Reporter Kutsai Zivanavashi probes the many causes of the problem.
Michael Chideme is the city council spokesperson. He explains why Harare is going through a dry spell.
We are in a drought season. We didn't receive enough rains this season. So we have since decommissioned one of our treatment plants. So this is putting pressure on the remaining one treatment plant, that is Moton Jeffrey, which is also not operating at optimum level.
He adds that the shortage of foreign currency in the country has also affected the availability of potable water in the city.
Shortage of water treatment chemicals as a result of forex shortages in the country or in the economy. All our chemicals are imported from outside Zimbabwe and we have to pay for them in US dollars. So we need that money to be able to fund the purchase of those water treatment chemicals. Also, the quality of our raw water is very bad now, meaning we need more water treatment chemicals, which again goes back to the issue of forex.
Lorin Mupasiri is the director of the Combined Harare Residents Association. She says the water shortages could have been prevented.
One of the main causes is actually lack of funding in terms of investing in the water infrastructure and also investing in the water treatment process. And the reason why funds are lacking, corruption, mismanagement of funds within the city of Harare.
Mupasiri says, in light of the prevailing drought, wetlands would act as reservoirs, but the wetlands in Harare are often parcelled out for development projects. Combined Harare Residents Association says Harare loses a decent amount of treated water through its dilapidated water infrastructure. This is happening against a mismanagement of a $144 million loan taken from China with the intention to revamp water infrastructure. Earlier this year, Harare and some parts of the country experienced yet another cholera outbreak, which claimed lives. A disease that has often spread due to unsafe water sources residents opt for when clean water is not coming through their taps. Chideme says the long-term solution would be building other dams around the city. Mupasiri says political will to resolve the matter will be critical and government should treat the water crisis with the urgency it deserves, since potable water is a human right. For VOA, this is Kudza Izinawashe from Harare.
As Zimbabwe battles to keep its economy afloat, corruption within state institutions is hampering efforts to turn the economy around. Andy Gondo gives us more on the story.
Parliament's Public Accounts Committee has unearthed what members say is evidence of mismanagement of funds at the Zimbabwe National Road Administration, ZINARA. In hearings, the committee found that ZINARA has been paying salaries for both the suspended chief executive officer, Nancy Masiwa Chamisa, and the current acting CEO, Methlin Mjokoro. Mjokoro has resigned because of anger over the allegations, and 19 employees have been arrested for fraud cases involving more than US$210,000. The committee chaired by Tendai Biti of the MDC Alliance says it established that the road authority has spent thousands of US dollars on hairstyles, food hampers and gym equipment for directors. This is happening despite what many drivers and government critics say is the dire state of the country's roads. In 2018, the Zimbabwe Auditor General reported that state-owned enterprises and state institutions are involved in massive corruption and maladministration. James Joa, an economic analyst.
One of the most serious concerns that has been eating on the fabric of the economy of this country has been corruption. And this has been especially so with regards to the public sector, including, of course, parastatals. The events at ZINARA are therefore a case in point. This is just one example of the rot that has pervaded our public institutions, parastatals.
Joa says the state must resolve to fight and stop corruption.
We need strong institutions to deal with corruption. There should be the will, of course, to arrest first and then prosecute the people who abuse public funds, and this should also be done in a transparent manner.
Odzi wants an order compelling Chitukutuku to give a detailed statement to the Police Asset Forfeiture Unit. The unit was set up in the Commercial Crimes Division to recover proceeds of crime, including seizing any property derived from such criminal activities. Some political analysts, such as Reginald Shoko, however, say that while investigating Chitukutuku is welcome, such cases tend to obscure the extent of corrupt activities torpedoing the Zimbabwean economy.
ZINARA seems to have been a private bank or a kiddie bank for certain people, because you'll then understand that if board will sit and approve such things, what more were they taking? Because what at the moment we're exposed to is what management has been doing. What more has been board doing? What has been happening with the ministers that have been in charge, that have been playing an oversight role and superintending these things? If they could watch such things happening, what was their benefit?
The Zimbabwe National Roads Authority builds and maintains the National Road Network. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
The Gambian government says it is working to scrap what it calls old draconian media laws. Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou says such restrictions have no place in a true democratic state. Reporter Pan Darium Bai looks at the issue of freedom of the press in The Gambia.
Amnesty International and other right groups once referred to The Gambia as one of the most dangerous places for journalists to operate in Africa, largely due to former dictator Yahya Jammeh's lack of tolerance for press freedom and human rights. That image has started to change following the election of President Adama Barrow. The country was recently ranked as the 9th most tolerant African countries in the World Press Freedom Index. Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou details the efforts underway to improve the media climate.
This involves the promulgation of a Media Services Act that will consolidate and modernize a variety of currently disparate and often obsolete media-related laws.
Tambadou says those include all colonial laws that have no place in any new democratic dispensation. Tambadou says a Freedom of Information Act is also being considered by the government. Sekou Jammeh is Secretary General of the Gambia Press Union.
We hope that this time these sayings will follow some action will follow, those statements. Concrete, actions, because we have been anticipating or expecting that for a very long time. We thought that, when the government came into office, media law reforms would be the first thing that they will do. No one in his state of mind would have thought that we will be 2 years and counting and still no reform of the media laws.
Jammeh says the journalist group had done its part when it comes to working with the government in accomplishing a media reform agenda. He says the ball is now in the government's court to ensure that such reforms are passed.
For us, we have engaged them on numerous occasions on this subject. We have supported their efforts. We have submitted policy papers to them regarding what needs to be done. We have also submitted even legal position paper, which was a study on all the media laws in the country and how they affect the operation of media, how they affect freedom of expression in the Gambia.
Jammeh says the relationship between the government and the private media had improved greatly under Barrow administration. He cited the recent World Press Freedom Index portraying the Gambia in a positive light after so many years of poor rankings.
We are 9th in Africa now. I think we are the new stars in Africa, ourselves and Ethiopia. It's really important because for the past 2 decades or so, Gambia has been ranked like the 3rd worst place for press freedom in Africa.
Jammeh has urged the Barrow government to speed up removing laws that hinder the work of journalists. For VOA Africa, this is Pan Darium Bai reporting.
An artifact of Namibia's historical development is to return to its shores after more than 100 years. A German museum announced today that it would return to Namibia a large stone cross that was used by navigators. Portuguese explorers erected the cross, which stands 3.5 meters tall and weighs 1.1 tons, in 1486 on Cape Cross. Several maps from the early period of Europe's exploration of Africa's coast showed the cross as an important navigational marker. During Germany's colonial rule in Namibia, the cross was removed and taken to Berlin. Germany has promised to speed the return of artifacts and human remains to former African colonies. The Berlin Museum's supervisory board decided to announce its decision to return the cross today. German government official Michel Mutterfering said, "The return of cultural objects is an important building stone for our common future with Namibia." The British medical charity Wellcome Trust is kicking off a new drive to reduce the deaths and disabilities caused by bites from poisonous snakes. Tens of thousands of people around the world are killed by snakes each year, and hundreds of thousands are sickened or disabled by them. The World Health Organization says about 500,000 Africans need treatment from venomous snake bites each year. Dr. Philip Price is the science lead for Snakebite at Wellcome Trust. He spoke to my colleague Kate Pound Dawson about the new program. He explains that treating snakebite is a very complex problem, hurt by a lack of data, old treatments, and the natural differences in snakes.
Wellcome is launching an £80 million snakebite priority area, and that will be over the next 7 years, looking to change the way that snake bites are treated. Before he passed away, Kofi Annan was referring to snake bite as the biggest health crisis that you've probably never heard of. And one of the reasons it's relatively invisible is that it does tend to affect some of the most impoverished populations, particularly agricultural workers whose work obviously puts them in close contact with dangerous snakes. So the data that we have on snake bite is a little bit shaky. But what we know from hospital surveys and community records indicates that snakebite kills in the region of 80 to 140,000 people every year. And that's about 300 people every day. But most people don't actually die from a snakebite. Particularly the local effects can be devastating, things like tissue destruction that will lead to things like amputations and skin contractures. About 400,000 people will experience these kind of lifelong, often permanent disabilities. So the combined effect of death and disability from snake bite is actually quite staggering.
Why then has it been rather ignored for so long?
Part of it is the people who it affects are slightly invisible to the health systems. But it's important to point out that the treatments themselves that we use are quite antiquated. They're based on technology that's over 100 years old. It still relies on collecting snakes and injecting the venom into horses. So it's a dangerous treatment. It's often quite expensive to produce, and it is expensive to buy for the patients. So quite often the patients can't afford the antivenom, and so they simply don't bother showing up to the hospital. What that means is the cases are not recorded, and so the local governments themselves probably don't even know that these cases are happening. They're simply just happening in the community, out of sight and out of mind. Various different policymakers and governments need data, things like the cost effectiveness of the treatments, how many cases they're having and where those cases are happening. They need that data to be able to make the tough decisions that many governments are faced with. And when you don't have the data to back it up, it tends to get dropped down the list.
Why is there a shortage? Why is treatment so antiquated?
It's a sort of a collection of different things. The invisibility of the patients means you don't have the data. And that kind of compounds itself with the treatments that are too expensive means that the producers aren't really able to sell what they make. It's because antivenom is only as good as the snake that it's raised against. So the antivenoms that you use in the US are no use in Africa. And that, from a medical product perspective, is very, very difficult because it gives you a geographical defined efficacy of your product, which then means it's already expensive to produce, and you have actually a very narrow market with which to sell it.
That was Dr. Philip Price with the Wellcome Trust in London. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners to our VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all others, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clottey, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
Stand up!